May, be ready for more Off-Grid with me, Void.
And me, Dave.
It's really not really about crosswords, although we have solved a cryptic one earlier, just to mine the P's and Q's and other letters in the words we've chosen as our subjects for today.
And there's no need for you to have solved the puzzle to follow along with this, but if you want to tackle it before listening, pause playback here. Well, not right here, because you'll miss me saying which puzzle it was. Still here? Okay. This episode we did the Guardian Cryptic of Sunday, April the 7th, 2024, which was number 1272 set by Pasquale.
And we will also finish the episode with a mini quiz, also inspired by that puzzle and set by General Knowledge, who is hopefully beamed live by satellite from our outside broadcast studio. Are you there, General?
I am. Hello.
Marvellous.
Hooray. Super to have you back on once more. That crossword has also supplied us with a favourite clue each to read and explain to you, sprinkled throughout the episode, starting with you, Dave.
Thank you. I picked 19 down, which reads, deposit dispatched, small amount of money enclosed. And you're looking for an eight-letter answer. I'll give you the answer and the explanation of that after we've heard from the general. Which word from the puzzle caught your eye?
My jump-off word was nine across. The first one, part of Molly's plan, a delightful walk by the seaside, Nine letters. So the answer for this is Esplanade, which I actually didn't spot until afterwards. It's hidden in the sentence, but walk by the seaside to me is always going to be Esplanade. And that's because my grandpa used to live on the Esplanade in Tenby, which is a very famous Esplanade because it's a very famous seaside town in South Wales and Pembrokeshire, of course. And he lived on the Esplanade in a flat that overlooked the sea. And I probably always thought that Esplanades had something specific to do with Tenby because we visited when I was a kid for many years. I lived abroad and we used to come back and always go there for the holidays. So it's like the place I feel like I come from most in the UK. But these days, I like the fact that Esplanades, you can find Esplanades all over the world. And they're always in great places because they're pretty much always by the sea. And I like the sea a lot.
Yeah.
But the reason why I like this word in this crossword today was because I didn't know about crosswords. I'd never heard about crosswords before I was in my grandpa's flat. And his father-in-law, I was always told that his father-in-law had invented the cryptic crossword, which I suspect was a slightly embellished line. But it turns out that, you know, now that I know a little bit more about this, his father-in-law was A.F. Ritchie, otherwise known as Afrit, who did actually come up with, he was a very early cryptic setter. He wrote crosswords for the listener in 1932 and onwards, and he did actually come up with sort of one of the tenets of cryptic setting, which was that you need not mean what you say, but you must say what you mean, which I hope that these clues pretty much all do. And back then I thought I'd never be able to do a crossword. I'd never be able to solve a clue, and I didn't sort of particularly want to either, because they just seemed too difficult, and I didn't think I'd, you know, I don't like failing, frankly.
Yeah, cryptic crosswords can definitely be daunting when you first come across them if you haven't got anyone to explain them to you. What the hell is this all about?
Exactly. I mean, it is, you know, it is its own language. You do need someone patient to sort of maybe hold your hand, or you do need to read a lot of books, or you do just need to have the right sort of brain, or perhaps a bit of all of that. But for other reasons, I decided to get into it just a few months ago. So yeah, I'm very much a beginner. But it just sort of, I like the way that Esplanade sort of jumped out from being the very first clue in this. And it reminded me of my grandpa. It reminds me of the seaside, which I love. There are great Esplanades all over the world. I was running on the Esplanade in Helsinki a couple of years ago. I was looking at a list of Esplanades the world over, and I was actually enjoyed the connection. There's a cultural centre in Singapore called the Esplanade that was built in the early 90s. And I used to live in Singapore. That was where I used to like come back and visit my grandpa in Tenby from.
Oh, very nice.
So, and I may have to do sort of a global tour of Esplanades because I haven't been to the Malecón in Cuba. There are many. I have aspirations to visit many now. So, yeah, that was why I picked this word. And I also like the doubling up of reminding me about my great grandfather.
The one that springs to my mind first is the one in Brighton, because I used to live there and skate up and down it fairly regularly especially of an evening, which is really nice to get out.
Hmm. Yes, I'm not a coastal fella myself, I'm afraid, so just visits, no family recollections. But the thing with the grandfather, it's the classic way of getting into crosswords, isn't it? It's an older relative who already does them, who kind of introduces the youngster to them. So, yeah, that's always thought of as the best way in, I think.
Yeah. And it really seems to be, because of people I've been chatting to in the last few months, it's always been like, oh yeah, I'd used to do them with my dad or with my mum. And for me, it was with my dad. Although my mum, who was actually Afrit's granddaughter, she's brilliant at them. Something to do when you're with your parents or your children or anyone, in fact.
Yeah. I really got into it through friends at juggling conventions. There we go, listeners, with your bingo card. Void mentions juggling. In between the juggling, quite often some friends of mine would be sat around with some cryptic crosswords, and I got into yelling out a synonym to help them out, and then they sucked me in with further explanations to how the thing actually worked and why it was Esplanade.
Yeah.
And not walkway. Okay, Dave, do you want to explain how that clue worked for us then, please?
All right, if you remember, it was deposit dispatched, small amount of money enclosed, 8 letters. Well, this one was a container and contents. The definition part was deposit, but despite the financial surface reading of the clue, it wasn't talking about a monetary deposit at all. If something is dispatched, then that's quite often sent. And a small amount of money, well, there's lots of things that could be, but in this instance, it's a dime. And if you enclose the one within the other, you get sediment, so rather an alluvial deposit. Well, that was quite a nice misdirection. Okay, General, what was your choice of clue?
My choice of clue was 22 across, sweet desert animal carrying artist, which needed to be answered in 7 letters.
All right, you can give us the answer to that one after Void's bowled us over with his choice of word from the grid. What have you got?
Well, it's May and the county championship is in full flow and 40 episodes in, and I haven't talked about cricket yet. So I've picked out the word maidens.
I thought you might.
Overs in which no runs are scored. Abbreviation M. I am aware that some listeners will already be saying, oh no, not sports ball. But we seem to be touching on cryptics a bit this episode, and if you are into cryptics, you do have to have at least a passing knowledge of cricket due to it providing lots of abbreviations and bits of terminology that a setter can and will exploit in the clues. So, where do we stand on cricket, General?
Yeah, this is tricky. I mean, I have I have realised that I do have to know more about cricket than I need to if I am going to manage to answer any questions. But I was discussing with someone very eminent in the solving world, and she said this was also something she struggled with, despite being really very brilliant. So yeah, I'm on the fence, frankly, because some of them can be a little tricky.
Okay, that's fine.
Yeah, it's like many things.
That's fine, Dave.
Well, you know, it's not my area of expertise, but I suppose I can feel thankful that it's that and not football.
Okay. Well, to anyone in the cricket is boring crowd, I'll say it's fine. It's fine. We all have our different points of view. But
I've certainly watched more cricket than I have football, so you can have that from me.
Okay, fair.
I didn't say it was boring. I think it's just complicated in the amount of terminology required to answer a simple, simple clue. But
yeah, that's true. Mm. But I think there's always something in any match that you can latch onto, and I think that's why I'm probably as much a fan of cricket radio commentary as I am a fan of cricket. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's just some little stat like. And that's Northamptonshire's highest second wicket partnership against Middlesex at Wantage Road. But I thought I would try and dig out some facts that non-cricket fans might find a bit more interesting. For which I am indebted to Andrew Ward's book, Cricket's Strangest Matches.
Okay.
And the first one in here to catch my eyes was the Bramble Bank game. Maybe because I recently put the Brambles in a crossword clue. Is anyone familiar with the Brambles?
Nope.
Does that mean anything to you?
I'm sure someone is, but I'm not.
Blank faces greet to me. Okay, it is a sandbank in the Solent.
Okay.
Which only surfaces twice a year at the equinoxes for about an hour or so, which is just enough time to take a couple of small boatloads out there and hold a cricket match, naturally.
A fairly short cricket match.
A fairly short one. And this is what the Royal Southern Yacht Club and the Island Sailing Club did in 1984. Island Sailing batted first and made 24 all out, which, depending on conditions, may possibly have been a very good score. I don't know. But the Royals won by scoring 25 for 2, the winning runs being hit with a 6, which was promptly declared a lost ball. Splish.
It went in the water.
Yes.
Yeah.
How?
He's fallen in the water.
Now I'm wondering whether there has ever been a cricket match on the Goodwin Sands, which I do know, which is in the channel just off the coast of Deal. And I have visited on a, it's again only visible very rarely, but I have visited on a day trip a long time ago. I think they even erected a post box that you could send a postcard home, but I didn't see anyone.
Oh, cricket. Really? Oh, maybe. Possibly then. Yeah. I thought the Goodwin Sands was quite notorious as being fairly dangerous, but maybe that's just for ships and not for
There's a lot of shipwrecks there. I guess it's a very busy stretch of water, and there's been a lot of shipwrecks over the years, but I don't know how often they run trips, but this was a long time ago, but it was fun.
Cool.
What's the bounce going to be like for the ball on that kind of a surface?
Well, it's possible they took a rolled up pitch with them and rolled it out, or if the sand is fairly wet, it can be quite compact, so they might have been using an exceptionally bouncy ball. I don't know.
Okay.
I'll have to get back to you on that.
Right.
I have some odd matchups of opponents. Who do you think would win in a match between a team of one-armed men and a team of one-legged men?
I'm going for the legs, the one-legged.
What do you kind of think? Yeah, I think I would agree with that.
Well, this was apparently a reasonably common fixture in the 19th century, usually as a fundraising event for old soldiers. And it was generally reckoned that the one-legged had the advantage. And I assume that's because batting one-handed would offer the biggest challenge. But then again, the one-legged team would be slower in their fielding, chasing after the ball. There was an 1863 match at Old Trafford, and the one-legged men did win to confirm this, but only by 21 runs, so fairly competitive, I would say. How about in a match between a team of smokers and non-smokers?
Well, assuming that all other things are equal, one would hope the non-smokers would be fitter. But, I mean, it also depends. Definitely all the other things being equal. You kind of think, when did this match take place? I can imagine a 19th century.
I'm wondering.
Where most of them are smokers.
Were they smoking while playing?
Well, there was a match in, I think it was 1884, that W.G. Grace took part in as a non-smoker. But the one I had details on was a little bit later. The 1886-87 England tour of Australia, and the last match
Why
of the tour...
Why did I think this was going to be 19th century?
Funnily enough, the last match of the tour was smokers versus non-smokers, with various sponsored prizes on offer from cigar companies. So you could win 250 cigars if you were the highest scoring batsman, or 500 cigars for the winning captain, or what have you, that sort of thing.
Which is a real incentive for the non-smoking team.
Yeah, I did wonder about that. There was a trophy, apparently, for them.
Oh, how nice.
And apparently the smoking team did walk onto the field smoking their cigars, but they put them out to actually play the game. The author of the book said, you could say this game had a lot of ashes at stake.
But I hope you won't.
Well, yes, sorry. The non-smokers batted first, and this was a first-class match, by the way, so a four-day match. And over the first 2 days, racked up a score of 803 for 9 declared,
Right.
Which at the time was the first score of over 800 in innings of first class cricket. By the fourth morning, the Smokers finished their first innings all out for 356, which effectively meant there was only going to be enough time to bat out a draw. But the interesting thing came on the last ball of the game. The ball was bowled, and Smoker William Scotton, batting, struck the ball gently towards point and then started sprinting, not up the wicket to score a run, but after the ball to claim it as a match souvenir. And when he picked it up, Sherwin, the non-smoker's wicketkeeper, appealed, and Scotton was given out, handled the ball, because the umpire hadn't called the end of the match yet. Presumably he didn't care because he had his trophy.
Marvellous.
A very silly game. Mm. There are lots more games like this, bizarre games described in the book, but sometimes it's the lack of cricket that's interesting. You've heard of rain stops play, but the book also details incidents where play was stopped by snow in England in June. Uh-huh. Flying ants, seagulls, crane fly larvae, swallows, a swarm of bee, and even a monkey. It's just not cricket.
A monkey stopped play.
Yes.
Marvellous.
General, could you explain how your choice of clue works for us now, please?
My clue, sweet desert animal carrying artist. So I figured that artist is often RA due to my new knowledge of this of these abbreviations. And carrying might mean that it was hidden somewhere in the clue, which is the sort of clue I've been trying to, you know, I like it when I solve. So I sort of whacked that in the middle. And a sweet, I figured it would have to mean that. So it is actually the desert animal is the camel, and it's carrying RA, the artist. And it means, and the answer is caramel, which means sweet.
Yeah. And a nice surface image of a friendly beast of burden.
Yeah.
My favourite clue was 25 down, biographies, not very short stories, four letters, which I'll explain to you after Dave tells us his choice.
Thank you. In a very recent episode, we had a puzzle with the word papyrus, which some listeners may remember, and I talked about both the typeface of that name and the writing material. Here, Pasquale's given us its modern equivalent, paper. And in case you're afraid that I'm going to talk again about the history of the substance itself, I'm not. I thought I'd look into the sizes and shapes of paper and their names and things. I think day to day nowadays, most of us are exposed to huge quantities of A4. Do you know why A4 is the size and the shape that it is?
Oh, because it is half the size of A3.
Well, kind of, yeah. In terms of the shape, this goes back to a chap in 18th century Germany called Georg Christoph Lichtenberg. He was something of a polymath, professor of experimental physics, I think Germany's first professor of experimental physics, a witty satirist, an amateur philosopher, a failed novelist, an Anglophile atheist, in contact with James Cook and Johann Wolfgang von Goethe and Immanuel Kant and Alessandro Volta. I did kind of hope that he would be in contact with our friend Humboldt, but no. But one thing that he did was he proposed a standard to supplant all these kind of varying sizes and shapes of paper. And his idea, this was in 1786, was for the sides to be in the ratio of 1 to square root of 2, which is about 1.41.
Okay.
Pythagoras' constant, apparently, because that's the dimension at which a sheet cut or folded in half along the long side will yield two smaller pieces of exactly the same shape.
Okay.
So that's what then got adopted. In terms of size, why it is the size it is, that waits until the early 20th century. Another German, Walter Postmann, he introduced a system using, not postman, Postman.
Okay.
Introduced a system using this ratio based on the idea where the largest sheet, the kind of base unit, would have a surface area equal to 1 square meter. And so this became an element of the Deutsches Institut für Normung, DIN 476. And then in 1975 was adopted by the International Organization for Standardization, became ISO 216, where it remains to this day.
Only 1975. So that's surprising.
Only 1975. Yeah, so a sheet of A0 has a surface area of 1 square meter, give or take certain tolerances. And so all the other sizes are halves down from that, which means that A4 is approximately 1/16th of a square meter.
Oh, yeah. Follows.
There are sets of related standards, of which the A sizes are just the best known ones. I mean, perhaps if you deal with mail shots, you might know the C sizes, because those are the standards for envelopes. So they're designed to be roughly 10% larger than their equivalent A paper. So you can mail out A4 documents in a C4 envelope and so on.
Okay.
So you think, well, that's A and C. There's an obvious question.
Where's B?
Is there a B? There are B sizes of paper. It's just that we don't use them much. They are designed and intended to be intermediate sizes between the A sizes. And they're derived from the B naught, having the short side being 1 meter long. So derived from that, you say a sheet of B4 is 250 millimetres by 353 millimetres. And that is the standard size in Japan for publishing manga.
Ah, okay.
So although we don't use it much or think of it much, the Japanese do. And so if you go online looking for like B4 paper, you'll find lots of it being advertised and sold as for manga.
I'm trying to figure out, does that make it slightly bigger than A4? It's in between A4 and
C4.
Big books.
So, of course, you were saying about 1970s. It is now a bit hard to remember British paper sizes before ISO 216. And I suppose the most... Obviously, we had imperial paper sizes, which I think Fool's Cap is the kind of one that is most commonly remembered.
Yeah.
A full sheet of foolscap was 17 by 13 and a half inches. So foolscap folio, i.e. folded into two, was 13 and a half by 8.5 inches, often rounded down to 13 by 8, which is kind of good for office work size, because that's about the same width as A4, about an inch longer than A4. And that's why cardboard document folders and ring binders that you would put A4 in are usually a little bit longer than you'd expect them to need to be for A4, because they were originally sized to design to take foolscap.
Right. Are you about to tell us why foolscap is called foolscap?
I can if you wish.
Go on then.
It just got its name from the way it used to have a watermark on it, which depicted the head of a jester or fool in that distinctive cap with the bells and tassels. There is a story that circulates that in England, Oliver Cromwell's rump parliament had the previously used King's Arms watermark on parliamentary proceedings replaced with the jester image as a sort of Yabu sucks to you kind of mocking of King. But apparently, this story is, how should we put it, apocryphal.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, i.e. there's no evidence for it whatsoever.
Yeah, so, I did know that foolscap had a watermark of a jester's head on it, but I didn't know that it was the name came from the watermark rather than the other way around. So,
yeah, apparently so. And I mean, I did try and find out why it had that, and I couldn't get anything beyond that apocryphal story, but who knows why it had that watermark in the first place.
Answers on a postcard, listeners.
Listeners, let us know if you know. Yeah. Anyway, so take us back to the answer and the parting for that clue that you shared.
Yes, it was a very brief clue. Biographies, not very short stories, 4, which I liked because the surface is true. They tend to go on a bit. Biographies, you need a synonym for biographies, and biographies, as books, are sometimes called lives, the life of Johnson, whoever, for example. The next two words are not very, and the word very is commonly abbreviated to the letter V. So it's lives, not V, which gives you lies, which you might call short stories. Are you telling stories again? Nice short clue.
I really like this, but I couldn't do it. So I like it. So it was sort of annoying, but I really liked it once I cheated and found out the answer. it's great.
I wasn't sure whether the short was linked to the stories part of the definition or whether it was linked to the very, because it's the short form of very is V.
Oh, so it could be that, sure, of course.
Which way to join that up?
Yeah, because lies don't necessarily have to be short. That's what I was assuming. Yes, I think you're probably right. It's a short version of very that's not there. Yes.
Yes.
Well done for spotting my deliberate mistake.
Okay, so quiz time, the bit I've been looking forward to most. Let's start with a question inspired by the word tangos. Okay. Which dance shares its name with a female lay religious order that originated in the Low Countries in medieval times?
Ooh,
crikey.
That's a cracker.
Sorry, a female lay religious order.
Indeed. I can give clues, but...
Okay, let's just start off thinking of some... Medieval, did you say?
Medieval, yeah. Sort of, I think we're talking 12th century and on. But
But the dance might not necessarily be that old.
The dance is much newer.
Ah.
Oh, okay.
It shares its name.
Charleston, waltz, merengue, salsa.
I mean, they're dances, so you're on the right track. There is no etymological connection between the two words. It's not known where, for example, the word I'm thinking of, why the female lay religious order is called this. So,
okay, this is the Poor Clares.
No, he's coming at you from the other end now. Yeah.
I mean, I'm not well up on my religious orders. You might have to give us a little bit of a hint on this one, I think.
Mm. Well, I can give you another clue is, if I say Cole Porter, he had a famous song that's about this dance.
Oh, would that be Begin the Begin?
It would, indeed.
Oh, very good.
So I heard of that song a long time ago, and I had no idea what Begin was or meant.
Well, I can tell you. So a begin is a slow rumba or a foxtrot, and which is the rumba is sort of the roll of the hips. It was popular in Guadeloupe and Martinique in the 1930s. Okay. And so I wondered what begin was or meant, because I came to it another way, which I'll tell you in a sec. But in Antillean Creole, a begin was a white female. This was the origin of the word for the dance, which you can now watch. There's a good obviously clip of this online. But I came to this because I was in Ghent last week, and in Ghent, which is a very lovely city in Belgium, you can visit Beguinages, which I'd never heard of, but I fancied a wander. So turns out Beguinages were where members of the Beguines used to live. And Beguines were semi-religious communities, and they were semi-religious in that they didn't take formal religious vows. They led lives of prayer and service without the church structure of religious vows. And the female residents chose to live religiously, but did so without vowing perpetual poverty or chastity or living in convents. And the one I was in, they're now sort of housing, some of it social housing, but they're delightful. They're sort of around a central courtyard. And I like the description that they used to be known as cities of peace. And I just like this idea of of these women living apart. I mean, they were quite radical in their way, if you think about the time. So anyway, it struck me, and the word tangos reminded me of this. So there you go.
Yeah. Okay. That sounds great.
I've never heard of that before.
Well done. And for question two, I've picked to jump off from the word sen. And I want to know, What happened for the first time during the swimming events at the 1908 London Olympics?
Ooh.
So does that mean it was the Paris Olympics?
No, this was, I mean, we are coming up to the Paris Olympics and something special is going to be supposedly happening at the Paris Olympics in the Seine. But what I want to know is what happened for the first time during the swimming events at the 1908 London Olympics?
Ooh.
Oh, London, of course. Was it the first time that women were allowed to compete?
No, there were still men only, I think, at that. But
do we have something to do with indoor versus outdoor, like a dedicated swimming arena?
Yes, yes. Did you say indoor arena? Yes, that's exactly right. So for the first time in the 1908 London Olympics, swimmers raced in a specially built indoor pool rather than in open water, which they last did in Paris in the year 1900. But can I tell you one fun fact about the 1900 Paris Olympics?
Go for it.
Yeah.
Excellent. The 1900 Paris Olympics is notable for being, well, it was the last time swimmers swam in the Seine for the Olympics, and it is also the only time the Olympics has ever included an obstacle race. So what happened was swimmers, over a 200-metre event, they had to climb over a pole, scramble over a row of boats, and swim under a row of boats. And there was a reason for this. It was because there used to be a tradition of linking the games to classical history and, excuse my pronunciation, that Secana, the Gallo-Roman goddess of the Seine, is represented standing on a boat. So the swimmers were mimicking her. Anyway, that's enough swimming.
Nice.
That sounds like it'd be a fun one to watch nowadays, because you could have underwater cameras. It probably would have been a bit more awkward to watch back then.
That is true. Anyway, it is apparently dubious as to whether the swimming will indeed be in the Seine, because they are not, I mean, I guess there's now just going to be a couple of months to go if we're in May, and it's going to be July when the Olympics kicks off. Water quality is a bit dubious still, despite them spending over £1 billion trying to clean it up. However, I'm very excited about this because I would love to go swimming in the Seine one day. So I'm keeping close track of this. Anyway, cool. Shall we move swiftly on to question three?
Yes, please.
So for this, I was inspired by the word rank, which was one of the answers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I would like to know, this is possibly a two-part question, but what is the name of Gilbert and Sullivan's most famous patter song? And for an extra point, which opera does it come from?
I would imagine it's Modern Major General, isn't it?
Well, exactly.
And
which is...
It's from one of the two nautical ones. It's either the Pirates of Penzance or HMS Pinafore, and I think it's the latter one.
I was going to say it's the former Pirates, isn't it?
Well, there you go. But I have an extra bonus question then, if that was far too easy. There is a cross-wording link, it turns out, I am the very model of a modern Major General. Do you know the cross-wording link?
Ooh,
is it something in the lyrics?
It
is. Does he sing about solving crosswords?
Kind of. He says, I answer hard acrostics. Acrostics being an early forerunner of crosswords.
As you were telling us last episode.
Yeah, it's very good.
Excellent.
Well, I started with a tricky one and ended with an easy one. But...
Yeah, well, doesn't matter. Yep. They're only easy if you know the answers.
Okay. You have been listening to Off Grid, the Not Really About Crosswords podcast. You can find all the details about this and past episodes at offgrid.tlmb.net. Please consider subscribing from wherever you get your podcasts. Give us likes, reviews, if those services give you the option to do so. Meanwhile, you can say hi to us on social media, where I'm at Skirwingle, a handle I also use for mycrossword.co.uk.
And I'm at The Void TLMB in places with tusks. And you may not know, we've never mentioned it before, but you can find us on Audible too. Find us there under, apparently, literary history and criticism or art. And once you've done this, give us a review.
I would have thought science and geography as well.
Well, who knows? They've obviously decided that's what we are. General, what are your latest recommendations for the listener, please?
I enjoy the book reviews that you can find on Instagram at definitely not a book club.
Excellent.
That's a good name.
Brilliant. Thanks very much once again, General, for your expertise and helping us out.
You're welcome.
And we'll see you all next time, folks. Bye.
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 Off-Grid is a TLMB production. Thank you to Pasquale and The Guardian for the crossword. Thanks for our theme tune go out to The Trudy every week for 14 pence. Find them on Bandcamp. Hello to our new listeners in Argentina, Indonesia, Cambodia and Poland, and to Michelle and the Fat Controller and anyone else who found us via our write-up on 15squared.net. Welcome, one and all. Still waiting for that listener in Antarctica. Until next time. Bye.
This is entertaining, isn't it, Void?
Yes.
Yes, I think this is cursed, though.
Hmm.